From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Junius Irving Scales, the only American convicted and imprisoned under the Smith Act for being a member of the Communist Party. His new memoir is called Cause at Heart, A Former Communist Remembers. Also today, I talk with John and Marina Baer, authors of the new book, How to Repair Food. It's a guide to fixing everything from your burnt casserole to the charred dish you burned it in. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Etta James, the first Queen of Soul, and book critic John Leonard reviews The Rat, the new novel by Günter Grass. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Junius Irving Scales, the only American to be convicted and imprisoned for being a member of the Communist Party. He was convicted under the Smith Act, a 1940 law that made it a felony to advocate or belong to a group which advocated the violent overthrow of the United States government. Scales' attorney for his appeal was Telford Taylor, who was the chief Allied prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. Celebrities like Paul Robeson, Eleanor Roosevelt, and New York Post editor James Wexler came to Scales' defense, seeing in his case a test of the principles protecting free speech. Scales served 15 months in prison before President Kennedy commuted his sentence on Christmas Eve of 1962. Junius Irving Scales has written an account of his experiences in the Communist Party. It's titled Cause at Heart, and it's published by the University of Georgia Press. Scales quit the party in 1957 after the Stalin revelations. After his release from prison, he worked as a proofreader for the New York Times, a position he recently retired from. He co-authored his book with a longtime friend named Richard Nixon, who is, by the way, not the former president. As a matter of fact, he spells his name N-I-C-K-S-O-N, just to clear up any confusion. Junius Irving Scales, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Did you go through many years of not talking about your past with new friends and colleagues?
Yes, I left the party 30 years ago, and I left prison about 26 years ago, 24 years ago. And after I got out of prison, I did a lot of wound licking and self-examining and trying to analyze what had happened to me and trying to break the grip of an ideology that's very consuming. So I stayed pretty much to myself and my family, and I was not active in politics from the time I got out of prison, at least not particularly active.
But I guess you're ready to tell your story now.
Yes, I feel the time has come. My friend and co-author Richard Nixon was urging me that an unexamined life is not worth the living, and besides that, the 40 years of anti-communist stereotype that we've been subjected to during the Cold War is so it's gotten to such an absurd level that it makes most communists thought to be something like a cross between mental patients and the Ku Klux Klan or something, running around plotting and talking about the need for violence and force. And it got a little much, and I decided I would tell my own story and try to tell it straight, and that would in some way counter the anti-communist stereotype that's been so prevalent for so long.
Let's talk about your story. You joined the Communist Party when you were still in college, and you were very excited about the ideals it represented to you. And I should mention here that you were from a very prosperous Southern family. Tell us about the ideals that you saw in the Communist Party that you wanted to work for yourself.
Well, see, I was growing up in the 30s. I was not politically inclined at all. And the rise of fascism was terrifying, and it was most of us sensed instinctively that we were going to be in the war before too long. And I was so sheltered that I didn't realize just what was going on around me. I didn't realize that I'd only known blacks as servants. I'd never known Negroes socially, and the same was true of white workers. And when I, by some chance encounters, I began to discover black students and white workers, and I was so overwhelmed by how isolated I'd been that I got terribly excited about the poverty that existed then. This was the South that Roosevelt spoke of as the nation's number one economic problem, the most miserable section of the economy, and so on. And this was a terrible time, and it was a terrible society. It was the variant of apartheid. The main difference being that in the South, the blacks were a minority instead of a majority. But all of the degradation, all of the discriminatory viciousness was there.
But joining the party, you saw that as a way to work for racial equality and also to be a union organizer.
Yes, you see, the party had an approach to everything that concerned me deeply. They were profoundly anti-fascist. They had sent the Abraham Lincoln Battalion to Spain, and I wanted to go, but I discovered about it too late. And the party were the most active organizers of the poorest workers and put their money where their mouth was. Some of my friends were almost killed in their efforts to organize unorganized workers. And so I met student communists the principal thing was that on the Negro question, liberals were wavering and trying to work within the policy of segregation. They were saying that it's just got to be more equal, but you couldn't have equality and segregation, as everyone realized by the end of the war. But a lot of liberals stayed the same, you know, and just accepted the separate part of the equation.
When you first joined the party, did you find that your fellow students or friends or neighbors distrusted you because you were publicly a communist?
Well, I wasn't publicly a communist then. This was, you know, 1939. Well, it's I still have people who are castigating me for not being a public communist from the beginning, but that's like asking me to put my head in a buzzsaw, because if I had proclaimed myself a public communist in 1939, I'm sure I'd have been run out of school. I would have been victimized in every possible way, and my life would have been in danger. Now the question is, is it deception when you don't say that you're? I didn't say I wasn't a communist, but I didn't say I was. You know, that was the whole business. And until 1947, I never proclaimed myself publicly a communist. I took positions that I believed in, but I never stated I was a communist publicly until 1947. Then the Cold War was beginning, and things looked so bad that I decided I was a reasonably respectable veteran, and I decided I would simply come out and be a spokesman for the party and try to counter some of the crazy attacks.
Well, you rose quickly through the ranks, and you became the principal organizer for a region that covered around four or five states, North and South Carolina, Tennessee, Mississippi. But after you became a leader, you thought that the party started to deteriorate, and this was in the late 40s. You were especially describing about that, a certain paranoia, a constant search for weak links and rotten apples within the organization. Were there things that you were called on to do as a leader that you really didn't want to do, but you did out of a sense of obligation because you were expected to do it for the party?
And there were all sorts of things. The party got terribly – this was after 1948 when they – Progressive Party came along. The party threw itself into the Progressive Party, and it was a disaster. And following that, instead of trying to seek out the reasons for the debacle, the tendency was to turn inward and look for the causes for the defeat in ourselves. So we started all those all kinds of security checks, and I was instructed to ask the most incredible personal questions of each member and so on. And I was also told to drop from the party all homosexuals and so on. And this was before I was the chairman then, but the district organizer was who was the responsible, the number one person. And I talked it over, and we found that the people that who had in this secret inquiry that I had to conduct, who had told me that they were homosexual or bisexual, these were people who were supposed to be dropped because they weren't so good security risks, and yet they were so courageous that they didn't have any hesitation of telling me that they were homosexual. And we thought about it, and we decided just to disregard that instruction, and we simply ignored it. But we had an awful lot of digging into ourselves.
I think there were other things that made you uncomfortable. For instance, the language that the party literature was written in.
Yes, that was always a problem. It was so cliché-ridden. You see, everything had to be oriented to the Soviet Union. We thought the Soviet Union was the socialist model. We thought it was the ultimate example of morality in international affairs and in internal affairs. And practically all of our literature had to stick in something about the Soviet Union. And also, we fell into such terrible cliches. We fell into it sounded like a sort of a screaming, abrasive tone to it, and it was quite unreadable stuff. Just very offensive.
Well, these are important things that you disagreed with, that the party was doing, expelling homosexuals and expecting leaders like you to actually do the expelling, and you didn't like the way the literature was written. How did you keep up with the party in spite of the differences that you had with it? What kept you working there?
Well, really, what happened is that I thought then, and I think now, that the people I worked with in the party were just about the finest human material I've ever encountered, and they were earnest, honest, and dedicated, and they believed in what they were doing. And the fundamental thing was that in the South, racism was so pervasive, so overwhelming, and so corrosive that you either fought it consciously or you just closed your eyes, blinked, let it wash over you. But whatever you did, if you didn't fight it, you were corroded to a degree by it. And it was just insufferable. And all of us had that commitment. All of us felt the same dedication to do what we could to rouse white people and to the outrages committed every day against Negro people, and to eliminate the racist laws that were on the books, where this was just something that brought us terribly close together, and it made us, we just couldn't leave, you know.
In 1951, the party asked you to go underground. This is a period when, I guess, most of the leaders in the party were being tailed by the FBI.
Yes. And me included.
Yeah, you say you always had people following you. Mm. What did it mean to be an underground party leader? First of all, what work were you expected to do?
Well, by 1951, I was married and had a small daughter, and the FBI just simply, they inhabited every house on the street I lived in, and anyone who came to see me was tailed, and they had telescopes focused on my house, and everyone that came and went was noted and photographed, and so it became very difficult for me to meet with people at all. So I had to leave home. I would stay with friends, frequently non-party friends, and I would stay in third-rate hotels and
under assumed names.
I had a code, so I would remember what name I'd used where, and I traveled frequently, usually at night. I would travel at night. First of all, it saved the payment for a night's lodging, and I was less likely to be observed in the dark. So I would hole up in some place and meet with people individually or with twos and threes. And that was what underground meant. There was nothing very spectacular. In fact, it was a pretty deadly wearing routine.
It meant being separated from your family
and
all the time.
It meant I was able to see my family first maybe once a month and then once in 6 weeks, and then finally it got to about once in 3 months, and it was just intolerable.
You were arrested while you were underground, and I want to ask you about that in a moment. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Junius Irving Scales, who is actually the only American to ever serve time in prison solely on the grounds of being a member of the Communist Party. He was indicted under the Smith Act, and he's written a memoir about his years as a party leader and his time in prison. And that book has just been published. It's called Cause at Heart. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Junius Irving Scales is my guest. He's written a new memoir titled Cause at Heart, A Former Communist Remembers. So you were underground with the Communist Party, going from city to city, organizing, mm-hmm. and you were arrested in that capacity.
Yes.
Would you describe what it was like? You were walking down the street when suddenly you were overcome by the FBI?
Well, the FBI knew that I was coming to Memphis, and they had two informers in the party, and these two informers told them where I would be precisely at what time, and they were supposed to meet me. And they were doing their level best to arrest me before that rendezvous, because that would expose their two informants, and they weren't able to do it. I evaded them by a whole bunch of routine maneuvers that I usually performed. And when I got three blocks from the rendezvous, an FBI man got on the trolley that I was riding, and I knew immediately. I just something crossed in our eyes, and I knew he was an FBI man, that I was spotted. So then it was a matter. I said, "Well, they know I'm here." So I got off the bus a block beyond the rendezvous spot. I walked around. It was beginning to pour. A thunderstorm came up, and it was getting dark, and it was there were FBI cars all down these blocks, a very quiet residential neighborhood, and it was quite a. It was the question was, would they arrest me, or would they just make my trip useless by following me so closely I couldn't go anywhere? I figured with the numbers they had, they were probably going to arrest me. So, as the rain started, I tore up a whole lot of papers, a lot of phony identity material, and so on, and also records that I didn't want them to see. So I tore them up in little pieces and put them down the storm sewer as the rain came, and then I walked toward the rendezvous, and it precisely. The time, 7:30 p.m., I hit the intersection, and about car doors opened every place, and a crowd of men waving guns and hopped out of their cars saying, "We got you, Scales," and that was my arrest.
Well, you, I believe, had trouble finding a lawyer to represent you. Now, the lawyer for your appeal was Telford Taylor, who was a lawyer on the Nuremberg trials. And he insisted on representing you as an individual, and he wouldn't have represented you if it meant representing the Communist Party. Why did he make that distinction? Why was that important to him?
Well, I think he wanted to have control over the case, and he didn't want to be dealing with any committee, and I think he he felt that he was representing an individual and didn't consider that he'd be representing the party, which was reasonable enough and was agreeable to me.
Your former lawyer, Telford Taylor, explains in the preface of your book that most of the people who were arrested and tried under the Smith Act were really tried for the clauses that prohibit distributing literature that advocates the violent overthrow of the United States or for conspiring to overthrow the government of the United States. But only a handful of people were actually arrested and charged with being a member of a group that advocates the violent overthrow of the United States. And because you were one of the handful that were arrested under that clause and the only person who was actually convicted under it, your trial took on a lot of significance.
Well, yes, they tried to do was to say that membership involved conspiracy, but of course that wasn't written into the law. This was an afterthought on the part of the prosecution, and what they did the usual Smith Act business of getting professional witnesses who were in the pay of the Justice Department, who'd get on the stand and rattle on for a couple of days at a time, citing this piece of literature Marx said in 1800 and something and Lenin said in 1913 and Stalin said in 1921, and all of this stuff, I was responsible for it because I had either sold it or this individual witness claimed that he had been taught that in a Communist Party school or something, you know, had been told to read this literature and so on. So all that made me responsible for everything ever written in over a period of many decades about the communist theory. So what you had was a table full of books piling up as they would cite this particular work and that particular work. And it was an absolutely bewildering thing. No jury could know what was going on. They hadn't the foggiest notion of what it was all about. They never produced a shred of evidence that I had ever done anything remotely resembling or advocating violence, I'd ever done anything subversive of the welfare of the country. That wasn't even the issue.
I'd like you to read the statement that you made at your first trial, to read an excerpt of that.
Oh, yes. Well, this was after I'd been convicted and sentenced to 6 years, and before sentencing, I had the opportunity to address the court, and I said, "Your Honor, I'm innocent of the charge in this case. Insofar as the issues are Marxism, Leninism, and my beliefs, I do not think they can be tried in a courtroom, but must be tested in the give and take of political life. No jury is competent to convict a man for his ideas, no matter how long a study they make. This jury had small opportunity to even understand my ideas through these rags and tatters of unfamiliar books, introduced and grossly misrepresented by the government. For all the world, this has been like a medieval heresy trial. Mr. Stanley," that was the prosecutor, "asked the jury to drive communism out of North Carolina. He disagrees with my views on Negro equality, on foreign policy, on unions, and on many other things. The democratic thing would be to encourage debate on such ideas in public forums. Mr. Stanley asks that my ideas be jailed with me."
Now, it's interesting that not too long after you read that statement, your ideas about the party changed. After the Stalin revelations, you quit the party, and I think for so many people who had been in the Communist Party, it was just absolutely defeating, traumatizing to find out what had been happening in the Soviet Union. You quit the party when you found out about Stalin.
Well, not immediately. We were so horrified to find out that Khrushchev had said that everything we had denied for years and everything that we had said in praise of the Soviet Union and Stalin and the Soviet Party was absolutely false. We were 180 degrees wrong, and we had it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Khrushchev himself told us. Well, it was devastating.
Well, this is always an occasion when something like this happens to totally reexamine your ideals and your politics. Did these revelations change your ideals and your politics?
Well, it didn't change my ideals because we'd put up a heck of a fight for Negro rights. We had done our darndest in organizing the unorganized. We had a tremendous local under that we were largely responsible for organizing of 10,000 tobacco workers. We had done a lot of really fine things. We'd done a lot of stupid things, and we undid a lot of what we had done that was good because of our doctrinaire nonsense and our subservience, you know, our praise making of the Soviet Union. So it caused us to, I think most of us were just about ready to throw Marxism-Leninism out of the window in pretty short order, and decided that it was pretty much what Lenin's vicar on earth in Moscow said it was on a given day, and we were so sick over that we just we were ready to call it quits.
Well, I guess here's what I really want to know: you served 15 months of a 6-year sentence, and then President Kennedy commuted your sentence. So you got out of jail after 15 months in jail. You had quit the party once you found out about Stalin. You had kept your ideals about racial equality and the importance of unions. Did you want to remain politically active once you got out of prison? Your ideals were the same, but you could no longer belong to the party. I don't know if you felt that you could act on your ideals anymore, but you weren't abandoning those ideals. So what did you do?
Well, of course, the thing that really clinched it was not – it was – when after the Khrushchev revelations, the Hungarian Revolution took place, and Soviet troops marched into Budapest, and Soviet tanks were shooting down workers in the street. So that iced the cake for us, and for most of us, about 80% of the party left at that time. And
but I guess, have you been politically active since?
Yeah.
Since quitting the party? And
no, I haven't been, because I pretty much lost confidence in my judgment on a great many things, and I've spent an awful lot of time of licking wounds and self-examination, and I didn't feel qualified to do much in the way of giving political leadership to anyone else, and I didn't trust my own ability to be effective for a great many years.
We only have about a minute left. I guess you actually kept a very low profile. You went to work as a proofreader for the New York Times in a kind of blue-collar job, the kind of work that you'd been working with blue-collar workers all your adult life. Now that you've written the book, do you feel like a different chapter in your life is going to open up?
Yes, I have a lot off my mind, I think, and I feel that I hope that this book will be a legacy that'll be worth something to those I leave behind.
Has it changed you to allow yourself to think again about periods that it seems to me you maybe have been trying to forget?
Oh, yes. I've gotten out from the grip of my ideology, and I'm even ready to do battle with other ideologies, such as the ideology of anti-communism, which dominates our country these days. And that's what I hope this book will do for me.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thanks for being here. Thanks for coming. My guest has been Junius Irving Scales, who's written a memoir about his years as a leader in the South in the Communist Party, and about his imprisonment for being a member of the Communist Party. His book is called Cause at Heart, A Former Communist Remembers. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Mary King, who was the communications coordinator for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. She's written a book about SNCC and her work with it, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Marina and John Baer, co-authors of How to Repair Food, explain how to keep your dinner guests from realizing they're eating a disaster. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks back at the influence of rhythm and blues singer Etta James. And book critic John Leonard reviews Günter Grass's new novel, The Rat. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of singer Etta James. Between 1955 and 1967, James had 10 songs that made it to the top 10 on the rhythm and blues charts. And in 1978, she was one of the opening acts for the Rolling Stones tour.
Sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before, no, no, yeah. I just want to tell you right now that ooh, I believe, I really do believe that something's got a hold on me, yeah.
Hard to feel.
The other day, when I was looking over all the great albums Etta James made in the 60s, I noticed something ironic. In 1965, when Aretha Franklin was still captive of a record company that thought she was a jazz musician, Etta James had released an album called Queen of Soul. It was a title that she'd certainly earned, even if it was one she'd never claim. Etta James was born almost 50 years ago in Los Angeles and rose to fame as a teenaged vocalist with the Johnny Otis Orchestra. Back when every hit had to have an answer, she came out with Roll With Me Henry, an answer to Hank Ballard's Work With Me Annie, the off-color smash underground hit. It put her on the charts in 1955, and she didn't leave for the next 18 years.
Something told me it was over. Yeah. When I saw you and her talking, something deep down in my soul said, cry, girl.
She recorded for Argo Records, the pop subsidiary of Chess, home of the Chicago Blues, and even her non-hits like I'd Rather Go Blind were near masterpieces. Since nearly everything she recorded went into the Rhythm and Blues Top 10, she was given the best producers and arrangers in Chicago and the Midwest. Even Berry Gordy had a hand in writing her hit All I Could Do Was Cry in the days before he started Motown Records.
Walk down the aisle on
But Etta James was not a glamorous woman. Ponderously overweight, with a penchant for platinum blonde wigs, she was a bad choice for crossing over to the pop world. And during the period of her biggest success, she was crippled by a terrible heroin habit. The cover of her amazing live album, Etta James Rocks the House, shows her with a big ace bandage on her arm, a really depressing sight. Still, she had that straight-ahead voice, that way of putting a song across that nobody else has matched. Her signature tune, Tell Mama, has been tried by others, but never equaled. With its chugging midnight hour bass line and its comforting message that not all women are so bad, it even became a pop hit in 1967. By then, though, the drugs were doing the would-be Queen of Soul in, and another queen was ascending the throne. Etta James checked into a detox center, and the public forgot about her for the most part. She's still around, playing a sort of dirty blues act that only shows off a fraction of her talents, but her records are still as great as ever.
Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
She would embarrass you anywhere. She let everybody know she didn't care. Give me a chance, I've been begging you. I just wanna take care of you. I want you to tell mom all about it. Tell mom.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guests are cookbook authors John and Marina Bear. Lots of cookbooks tell you how to cook, but the Bears have written a book that tells you what to do after you've ruined the recipe. It's a humorous but practical manual called How to Repair Food. The book is organized alphabetically, beginning with advice on how to save tough abalone, make a seafood chowder, and ending with tips on what to do with overcooked and soggy zucchini. They suggest pureed zucchini cream soup. They've also included appendices with additional information on kitchen disasters ranging from remedies for burned food to how to cook an emergency first aid dinner after you've ruined the real meal. John and Marina Bear dedicated their book to their mothers. I asked them why.
The dedication is to our mothers who, in effect, made it possible and necessary. we are both only children born to older mothers who were, we may say they understood this, terrible cooks.
So that when we started cooking ourselves and together, the idea of trying all these wonderful exotic things that we had heard about but had never eaten, what it produced was that terrible moment in the kitchen when you think you have followed the recipe exactly right, and there's something awful that's happening in the stove. It's gone flat, or it's probably sticking to the bottom, or it smells funny.
Also, we are cookbook junkies, as many people are. We buy lots of them. We enjoy reading them just for pleasure. And it is extremely rare for any cookbook to acknowledge that they are less than perfect, that if you follow the directions exactly, that things will look just as beautiful as those glossy color photographs in the book. And we all know that simply is not the case, whether sometimes cookbooks make mistakes, whether it's the humidity in the air or the atmospheric pressure or the tomatoes that are juicier than the one that the cookbook author did, things absolutely go wrong, and cookbooks don't acknowledge this. So here was a real niche in the world of writing about food, a niche to be filled.
The way I understand it, you spent a really long time intentionally cooking up disasters so that you could figure out how to repair them.
Which led to one of the absolute finest hints in the book, which is boiling cloves in either sugar water or vinegar on your stove to cover up very funny smells, which you have created because you were burning the things which you then figured out how to repair.
Right. When you make the smells better in the house, things generally don't seem nearly as bad. This is a tip that is worth several $100,000, by the way, because when we were selling a house that was very hard to sell, when we made this wonderful smell in the house, as people came to look at it, it gave people apparently this nice, warm, homey, folksy feeling, and the house sold very promptly.
What were some of the dishes you intentionally made into disasters?
Flat soufflés. A flat chocolate souffle is wonderful. But there's another one. You've got to simply cover it up and rename it.
Into what, chocolate bar?
I've always liked death by chocolate.
Death by chocolate, right.
Yeah, if you put enough chocolate on it, almost anything, people will forgive and even not notice what's underneath.
But if you do it with a savory souffle, then you have, you call it a frittata instead of a souffle, and you never tell them what it was supposed to have been, and they're amazed. How do you get your frittata puffy on the edges like this, and you smile enigmatically?
I think one of the absolute classic ones, and also one of the great, sort of the holy grail in this food repair world, is oversalting. When something is too salty, what do you do about it besides throw it out? So we spent a lot of time oversalting things, and then going into the chemistry lab of the kitchen trying to figure out what to do.
What'd you come up with?
Oh, the only thing that absolutely works without fail every single time is adding more stuff that isn't salted. If your soup is too salty, you put more liquid in. Of course, this doesn't always work. The potato thing is intriguing.
Yes. Slicing raw potato, floating it on the top. This is assuming you've got enough liquid. The potato absorbs somehow, magically, absorbs some of the salt in the sauce of whatever it's there. You then either have a choice of removing all the potatoes or if you combine them back in, you get some of the salt back in, but then you've made more stuff and maybe that helps too.
As in most of the stuff we talk about, there is no absolute one perfect way to do it. It's kind of the philosophy of the whole thing, that it's, you know, before you throw it out, at least stop and pause and think, is there something I can do? And
a little pinch of brown sugar sometimes seems to be counteracting the saltiness, especially if it's in a sauce that has tomatoes. These are the kind of hints in the book.
You suggest keeping a first aid kit of food around for emergency rescues and emergency dinners that have to be made. And you have some surprising ingredients in your first aid kit. One of them is a box of mashed potato flakes. Why do you think people should have that around?
It's a thickener, and it's food. It can be instantly dropped into certain kinds of soups and gravies. You get a sense of this when you've been doing it for a while. If you can dump mashed potato flakes into the stew when it looks more like a soup with lumps, you're adding some nourishment and you're also thickening it up a little bit.
You also recommend having a can of either cheese sauce or cheese soup on your first aid kit shelf. What would you do with that?
Cover things that it might be compatible with that taste fine but look funny, or
that's one of the great sort of meta tips or generic tips is cosmetic attention to things. If something goes terribly wrong, covering it up, the literal meaning of cover up is really a very practical sort of thing to do. So a nice thick cheesy sauce is absolutely fine, or a dessert sauce or whatever.
There are times when you will cook something and it will stick on the bottom, a vegetable perhaps. By the time you've taken it carefully off, you've left a layer of burned vegetable stuck on the bottom of the pot, and now there's not enough. And many vegetables can be rescued by putting a layer of cheese on the top. If you have time to run it under the broiler or shake a little paprika on it, fine. If not, the sauce looks as if you cared, and it probably will cover your kitchen disaster.
You could even add the cheese soup to the mashed potatoes and make a
naming, a disaster which you then had to correct.
No, naming dishes is very important, too. If you tell people, this is my grandmother's famous mashed potato cheese flambé. Yes. Right. Put a little sherry on it and set fire to it, and people will think you probably meant to do it.
You both have a real gift for language and for naming foods. And I know that you have an entire dinner menu comprised only of ingredients on your first aid food shelf. So you have a dessert that's called poached fruit with vanilla sauce. Oh, that sounds really good, doesn't it? Why don't you tell us what the recipe really includes in that lovely named dessert?
You have fruit that you've drained it.
Fruit, you've drained it. Wait a minute. Can I just...
You've got canned fruit.
We have canned fruit. Let me just candidly spell out what poached fruit with vanilla sauce is.
Okay.
It's some canned pears with vanilla pudding on top.
That's
basically
what it is.
That's what it is. You also have a whipped topping made out of chilled evaporated milk.
Mm. sounds great.
It is truly not bad. And when you imagine the psychology of the situation where, I mean, there you are and your cake has absolutely burned in the oven because you've forgotten about it, and the boss or somebody important is there at dinner and you want a dessert.
I have a feeling when you were at the height of your research, you spent a lot of time eating out after your disasters were finished.
It was refreshing from time to time, but that is truly the last resort, because we really tried to maintain this policy of don't give up, that there is something to be found in everything, which it didn't always work out. When you have absolutely charred the steak to where it's charcoal, then you can use it for sketching pictures, but it is hardly, there is really no way whatsoever of turning that kind of thing back into usable food.
Now that your secret is out that you burn a lot of food, but you know how to save it, are fewer people willing to come over and risk dinner at your place?
Our children are eager to do it. There was a long period when I think going to mom and dad was a very strange experience, something that they could tell their friends about, but it was not exactly to be looked forward to. No, I think our reputation is sound enough that people come willingly, and of course they are more inclined to ask questions if something does arrive with a sauce on it.
The question is, did you intend to do it this way?
What was this before? Before the disaster? And was it an intentional disaster? Are you working on a sequel already?
Well, thanks a lot to you both for talking with us.
Thank you,
Terry.
John and Marina Baer are the authors of How to Repair Food, published by 10 Speed Press.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the fram sauce with the awesome fee, with Shafafa on the side.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hello, Terry.
What do you have for us on today's show?
The White House announced today that Secretary of State Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze will be meeting in September to discuss an arms deal. We have a story on Attorney General Edwin Meese testifying today for the first time before the Iran-Contra committees. Also, a story on Panama today in its second day of a general strike.
Who are you speaking with, Renee?
Well, I spoke with David Bloom, a writer from New York, on the subject of couch potatoes. According to a recent Gallup poll, 17% of Americans say their chief leisure time activity is lying down, usually on a couch.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Characters from two novels by the German author Günter Grass, Tindrum and the Flounder, reappear in his new novel, The Rat. Although this novel is set in the future, Grass is also interested in stories that begin once upon a time.
All of Günter Grass can be read as one big fairy tale about Germany. When he can't find what he wants in the Brothers Grimm, he invents his own dwarves and wolves and witches and trolls. His mind itself is a black forest full of imaginary beasts. This grimmest of fairy tales usually ends when Hitler eats the sleeping princess. Recently, however, Grass seems to have been suggesting that fairy tales themselves are partly to blame for Hitler. punitive and misogynistic, they propagandize for nationalism, self-righteousness, and paranoia. Much of German literature seems, in fact, to be a rhymed yearning for death, and none of that high German culture, including Bach and Mozart and the novels of Thomas Mann, saved a single designated witch from the famous Nazi ovens. The language, after World War II, had to teach itself to speak again without a taste of shame. Now, in The Rat, Grass kills off fairy tales entirely. All hope is gone, he says in one of many little poems in this long novel. For fairy tales, it shall be written here, are dying with the forests. The forests are dying from industrial development and acid rain. Without forests, of course, children can no longer get lost. In one of the various subplots in this very rich Rat, fairy tale characters seize power, briefly, in Germany, and demand a re-greening of Middle Europe. They are exterminated. In another subplot, five feminists search on a barge in the Baltic for a vanished matriarchal city and listen to the jellyfish sing, "These women will be vaporized." In a third subplot, Oscar returns from the Tin Drum as a middle-aged producer of video cassettes on his way to Danzig Gdansk, where he will show films he has already made of the apocalyptic future. He, too, will be vaporized in a Sunday nuclear strike. In a fourth subplot, an artist who counterfeits authentic Gothic for needy cathedrals is tried and convicted for the treason of a sense of humor. Where is the novelist while all of this is going on? He is either dreaming or marooned in a space capsule orbiting an Earth on which everything has been obliterated except the busily repopulating rats, some wood lice, a stinging bluebottle, and a flying snail. In either case, a loquacious she-rat, which was his Christmas present, explains the future and scourges man's past. We also hear a lot about new punk religions and hybrid rat men with blue eyes and blonde hair, and the post-historical significance of Solidarity, the outlawed Polish labor union movement. An alarmist Günter Grass is having black fun, with movies as fairy tales, with literature as lies, with art and politics as forgeries, and with rats as symbols of everything we want to get rid of, from scruples to children to, of course, the Jews. Grass on rats is less charming than Melville on whales, and it helps some to have already read The Tin Drum and The Flounder. But what the Dennis the Menace of Western literature ends up giving us is his own sort of poisoned apple. Wake up, before we all turn into big, bad Germans.
Fresh Air's book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Rat, a new novel by Günter Grass. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with singer Frankie Lane. He has a new recording of the Western themes he made famous, the themes from High Noon, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Rawhide. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a collection of old concert recordings from the Music and Arts Program of America series. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will read the headlines and discuss how they're written. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Happy birthday, Chris. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.